Welcome to tonight's Bible class. Sam's kindly at the very last minute leapt in to help us. So we're going to look at the centurion's servant from Luke 7. So we're going to take a short reading from Luke 7. And because the title is the Healing the Centurion's Servant, I'm going to read the first 10 verses. Thanks, Sam.
Okay. So we're going to talk about the healing of the centurion's servant tonight from, as we've seen, Luke chapter 7. And we know, I think, that the key to understanding anything that Jesus does or anything he says is really looking at the context of where the event is held. So this healing of the centurion's servant is found in two records. It's found in Luke chapter 7, as we've just read, and in Matthew chapter 8. And both times it's set in the same context. It comes straight after the Sermon on the Mount. So Matthew chapter 8, obviously, comes after Matthew 5, 6 and 7, so that's the Sermon on the Mount. And Luke chapter 7, using the same logic, comes straight after Luke chapter 6, which contains a large chunk of the Sermon on the Mount in it as well. So it starts in, I think, verse 20 of Luke chapter 6 with the Beatitudes and goes through for the rest of that chapter. Now, I'll get probably you guys to look up some of these quotes and read them out for me because I haven't done any slides for tonight. So, Max, you're up first. And we're going to read just the end of Luke chapter 6. And can you read for me Luke chapter 6 and verse 46 to 49, please?
And why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? Whosoever cometh to me and heareth my sayings and doeth them, I will show you to whom he is like. He is like a man who goes in that built an house and dig deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock. But he that heareth and does not is like a man that without a foundation built an house upon the earth, against which the stream did beat vehemently. And immediately it fell, and the ruin of the house was great.
Okay, thanks. So in verse 46 there, Jesus says, "You call me Lord, Lord." So the word Lord there, which you might be familiar with, is the Greek word kyrios, which means supreme, a ruler, a master, a lord, a controller. So Jesus is saying, "You acknowledge me as your master." And yet the question is, having just listened to the sort of Sermon on the Mount, which outlines his ideology, for want of a better term, are you really my servants? You've heard the Sermon on the Mount. Are you really my servants? So how do we tell if they're his servants? Well, verse 47 tells us you have to hear his sayings and do them. So you're his Lord, I'm your Lord, if you do what I say. But by way of contrast, they're in verse 49, there's going to be people who hear them and don't do them. So clearly I'm really not their master because they're not doing what I tell them to do. So to become the servants of Christ, there's really two simple steps. And there's one really key one. So if we call Jesus Lord, so it's not enough to call him Lord. It's not even enough to hear what he says. So he says, and why call ye me Lord and do not the things which I say? Whoever comes to me and heareth my sayings and doeth them, in verse 47. But in verse 49, him that heareth but doeth them not. So hearing Jesus doesn't make us his servants either. There's really only one thing that does make us his servants, which is... So there's what's the one thing that we need to do to be his servants?
Doing.
So it's pretty simple.
We can call Jesus Lord.
It doesn't make us his servants. We can even hear what Jesus says, still doesn't make us his servants. It's really only if we do what he says that makes us his servant. So that's sort of the lesson for us, which is at the beginning, so that's handy. And we're going to really look and see how this idea is reinforced by the miracle of the healing of centurion servants. And the lesson is the same in Sean. Romans chapter 6, verse 16.
Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves, slaves to obey, you are the ones slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness?
Okay, so Paul in Romans says exactly the same thing. We've got two options. We can either yield yourselves or submit yourselves to sin, which leads to death. You can be the servant of sin, or you can be the servant of righteousness, be the servant of God, be the servant of Christ. But it's the obedience. It's whoever you're obedient to that makes you the servant of that person or that entity. It's really who you're obedient to that makes you that person's servant. Doesn't matter what you say. What matters is what you do. Who you're obedient to makes you that entity or that person's servant. That reveals the true master, whether the master is sin or whether the master is righteousness. So same lesson, just different words. Joel, can you do Matthew chapter 7 for me? Matthew chapter 7, verse 28 and 29, please. And this again, so this is right at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, before Matthew launches into the healing of the centurion's servant. And this is what Matthew has to say. And again, it's the same idea. Thank you, Joel.
And it came to pass, when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority, and what is described.
Okay, cool. So he's got authority. So once again, this idea that Jesus has got authority and the scribes has none. So again, the idea of authority has the idea of command, being able to sort of tell people what to do. Who do people obey? Is it the scribes in Matthew chapter 7, verse 29, or is it Jesus? So they're perceiving that Jesus is someone with authority, which the scribes lacked. And this really, so this is all in the lead up to the healing of the centurion servant. It really gets to the heart of what Jesus does next, because the key to this miracle is really authority and master-servant relationships. Servants, masters, servants hearing their masters, servants doing what their masters tell them. So in Luke chapter 7, which we've already read, so I won't get anyone to read that, but Luke chapter 7, verse 8, and this is the amazing statement of faith by the centurion. The centurion says, "For I also am a man set under authority." So once again, that word authority, which we saw in Matthew chapter 7, verse 29. "I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers. And I say to one, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh, and to my servant, do this, and he doeth it." So the words of the centurion are really the key to this miracle. And it's what Jesus sort of makes him marvel in verse 9, I think it is. "Yeah, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel." Amazing statement of faith, Jesus says, and we'll see why it's so amazing a little bit later. So what is it about this statement that makes it so amazing? What does the centurion say exactly? Well, he calls Christ Lord. The Greek word is kyrios, and he calls him that in verse 6. So he says to him, "Lord, trouble not thyself," in verse 6. So that's our word kyrios, our, you know, Lord, Lord, people that say Lord, Lord. So he acknowledges that Christ is his master. But you'll notice when we read verse 8 that he doesn't say, you know, "just like me, you're a man with authority." He's a centurion, so he's over 100 soldiers. So he doesn't say to Jesus in verse 8, "just like me, you're a man with authority. You know, just like me, you can command your servants to do anything or your soldiers to do anything and they'll obey you." Notice carefully what he says in verse 8. He says, "you are just like me, you are a man under authority. And you also have servants under you." So the centurion, and the amazing statement of faith that he makes, is that he recognised that Christ was like him, a man who received his authority from above. So that's the amazing thing about what he says. He says, yes, you've clearly got the authority from God. There's someone above you who gives you the authority to do these miracles and the power to do the miracles and the teaching, and you've also got servants under you as well. So he recognises that Jesus is like him, a man who receives his authority from above, and it's only because of this authority he received from above that he has authority over people below him as well. So in the military, of course, they call it chain of command. And in Roman times, it literally reached right up to Caesar. So the Caesar commanded whoever was below him, down through the ranks, down to the centurion, and the centurion commanded all the men below him. So the centurion recognised that he's only got authority because it was delegated to him by Caesar. And Christ only had authority because it was given to him from God. So this is the amazing statement of faith that made Jesus take note of this man. The Jews, of course, on the other hand, were always questioning his authority. They were saying, you know, by what authority do you do these things? And who gave thee this authority? They ask him in Matthew 21. So they're always questioning his authority, whereas the centurion says, I know exactly where your authority comes from. It comes from above, and that's how you have this power. The Jews, on the other hand, always questioning it. So the centurion really summarises the issue in that verse 8, really, where he says, I'm a man set under authority, and I've got under me soldiers. And I say to one, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh, and to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. So Jesus has already asked in the previous chapter, in Luke chapter 6, who are my servants? Those who hear my words and do them. And the centurion asks in Luke chapter 7, verse 8, who are my servants? Well, they're the people who I speak to, and they do what I speak. I say, go, and they go. I say, come, and they come. So that really is the key to understanding this miracle. So how does it play out? I guess it's a bit like reading the last page of Agatha Christie novel first, and you know who did it, and then we read the book. So we know that the key is servants and masters, and authority and servants who obey their masters. So servants who are told to go, and they go, and come, and they come. So who has the authority in this story? What are the masters and the servants in this story? Well, the first relationship, the first servant-master relationship is in verse 2. So in verse 2 it says, a certain centurion's servant who was dear unto him was sick and ready to die. So the centurion's got a servant. So clearly the master here is the centurion, and the servant is obviously his servant. But this servant is sick, isn't he? And he's almost, in fact, dead. And this master has no power to heal him. So the centurion, despite all the power that he has over the men under him, and even over this servant, he can't say, go to this servant, and he will go. As much as this servant might want to go, he's physically incapable of doing it. And this, the master, in this case, the centurion, has no power over sickness, much less over death. So he needs someone, the centurion needs someone who is master over both of these things to make his servant better. So that's the first clear relationship of servant and master, the centurion and his servant. The next one is in verse 3. So the next master-servant relationship is in verse 3-5. So do you want to read that for us next, child? Yeah, you. Luke 7, verse 3 to 5, please. Okay, so he heard. So he's hearing stuff. So remember how important this is back in when Jesus is talking back in Luke chapter 6. So he heard.
And when he heard of Jesus and sent unto him.
He sent unto him. Go on.
Sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And when they had come to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this. For he loved our nation, and he had built this synagogue.
Okay, so now it doesn't mention any servants or masters in these verses, but clearly, according to our definition of a servant, someone who does what is told, one who goes when his master says go, the elders of the Jews here are the centurion's servants, aren't they? So he, in verse 3, the centurion sends these elders to beseech Jesus, and in verse 4, they came to Jesus and besought him, just like they've been told to do. So the centurion said, go and beseech Jesus. They went and besought Jesus. So here, clearly, the centurion is the master, and the elders of the Jews are his servants. He's got authority over them. He can send them, and they go. He can tell them to beseech Jesus, and they go and beseech Jesus. So just stop and think about the sort of hypocrisy of their situation for the moment, these elders of the Jews. They hate the Romans. They refuse to acknowledge Roman authority over them. At every opportunity, they sort of endeavoured to throw off the yoke of service to the Romans. They hated the Romans, even if they didn't hate this one in particular. And to obey one, to obey the commands of a Roman, went right against their principles, such as they were, and of course their dream of an independent Jewish state. Yet they have to obey this man, don't they? Because he is their master. They are the centurion's servants. And it's not only that, but they're forced to ask Jesus, a man who they also hate, to perform a miracle that they refuse to believe that he has the power to do. So it's the elders of the Jews who later ask in Luke chapter 20 and verse 2 by what authority Jesus performs his miracles. They can't refute the miracles. They can't say they're not happening, but they refuse to believe in the power, the authority of Jesus as the performer of these miracles. And yet here they are, sort of beseeching Jesus to heal the centurion's servant. And I imagine they're doing it, you know, through gritted teeth and probably to the amusement of Christ himself. I'm sure he would have seen the irony of the situation as he listens to them sort of, you know, begging a man who they refuse to believe at the command of a Roman who they refuse to acknowledge as their masters. So these are unbelieving servants, aren't they? Now, we are all servants. We all carry a message. The question is, do we believe it? Are we like these Jewish elders who carried a message that they had no faith in? Or, not do we believe it? I think clearly the Jews believed that Christ could perform the miracle, but it wasn't something that they believed could change their lives. The Jews knew about the miracles, they'd seen them performed, but somehow in their brains they'd sort of lost the connection that told them that they actually needed to do something about it. They could carry the message, but they couldn't live the message. They could hear the word, but they couldn't do the word. They could even speak the word, but they still couldn't do the word. So they could say, Lord, Lord, to Jesus, but they couldn't do what he commanded. So the lesson in that, I guess, for us is that we are all servants as well. We all carry a message. We all carry the gospel. We all claim to be Christ's messengers, his servants. But do we do the message or just speak the message? Do we actually serve our Lord or do we just call him Lord? So the next servant-master relationship is between the centurion and his friends. So in verse 6, Zoe, can you can read?
And Jesus went with them.
Thanks.
And when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof.
Okay, so here the centurion sent friends to Jesus. So once again, he's saying, go, and they go. So these friends are, you know, probably Gentile. And while the centurion was obviously very kind to the Jews, it's pretty unlikely that his social status as a sort of filthy, uncircumcised Gentile would have allowed him to make too many close friends among the Jews. So his friends are probably Gentiles. But even, you know, once again, the centurion has the authority, even amongst his friends, to say go, and they go. And I think their relationship is not, you know, dissimilar to the one that we have with Christ. In John chapter 15 and verse 14 to 15, ye are my friends if ye do whatever I command you. So again, this not just being servants, but also friends. If you do whatever I command you, then you're my friends, says Jesus. Henceforth I call you not servants, for the servant knoweth not what his Lord doeth, but I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you. So, yes, we are Christ's friends, but he is still our master, isn't he? And he is our friend if we do what he commands us. So in the same way that these people were the centurion's friends, but they were still obliged to do exactly as he commanded. Now the next servant-master relationship is the one we've already touched on. The centurion acknowledges that Christ is his master. So in verse 6, he calls Jesus Lord. He calls him Kyrios, this, you know, Lord, Lord, that we've already looked at. Lord, trouble not thyself, for I'm not worthy that thou should enter under my roof. So he calls him Lord, Kyrios, and he describes himself as not worthy. So again, there's no doubt that I think that the centurion saw Jesus as his master. So that's the next servant-master relationship between Christ and the centurion himself. And I think the final servant-master relationship is between Christ and whatever was afflicting the centurion servant. We're not told what the illness was. But it says in Luke chapter 7 and verse 9 and 10, when Jesus heard these things, he marvelled at him. He turned him about and said, I've found not so great faith, not in Israel. And they that were sent returning to the house found the servant whole that had been sick. So Jesus doesn't make any command. And the illness obeys him like he does elsewhere, you know, when he says sort of come out of him or something like that, or stand up or something like that. But clearly the disease here leaves the servant at Christ's authority. So Jesus is, as we already know, the master over disease and ultimately, of course, death. They both obey him. He is a master over both of them. And so the whole miracle is built around these servant-master relationships. Who has the authority is the question. Who does what the master says? And in the end, of course, the Jews are shown to be faithless servants. They can say words, but they can't do stuff. And the centurion of the Gentiles is revealed to be the faithful servant. He calls Jesus Lord, and he hears and does his word. The elders of the Jews were obedient to the earthly authority of the centurion, but that obedience really reveals their hypocrisy. They refuse to obey the heavenly authority of God. They refuse to obey the authority of the Son of God, despite, you know, the clear evidence of all the miracles that they'd seen. The Gentile centurion, on the other hand, freely acknowledges Christ's authority, and importantly, most importantly, the source of that authority, that it came from God himself. So in acknowledging that Christ's authority was derived from God, he sort of leaps and bounds ahead of any of the Jews, or really anyone in Israel, as even Christ's disciples. And so Christ says, I haven't found so great faith, not only in Israel. So that's all we want to say about the healing of the centurion servant. But and that might sound like that's the end of the talk, but sorry, we're only halfway there, because of course, there's another Gentile army captain who acknowledged God's authority and another faithless Jewish servant who refused to do so, isn't there? Who is that?
Cornelius and Peter.
Cornelius and Peter, yes. I'm thinking Old Testament.
Naaman.
Okay, so let's have a look at Naaman. So have a look at 2 Kings chapter 5, and this is going to be a bit of a reading and comprehension exercise. So I'll get people to start reading from James, heading off that way probably. So yeah, just before we start, keep in mind these sort of key ideas that we've seen already in Luke chapter 7. So we're in 2 Kings chapter 5. So keep in mind the key ideas that we've seen. So masters, servants, authority, masters saying go, and the servants going. And let's see how some of these very similar themes play out. You know, an event that occurred, what, I guess, 500 years earlier. And we'll see how it plays out. So, yeah, James, take it away.
How many verses?
Oh, well, you can start with... Let's go with, I'm going to interrupt you a lot, so you can do six verses.
Now Naaman was a commander of the army of the
king of Aram. He was a great man.
Okay, so just like the centurion was in Roman times and in Roman tombs, he was the captain of the army, and yet, as he acknowledged, he was under someone else's authority. And so the case is here with Naaman, isn't it? He's under the authority. He derives his authority from the king of Syria, just as the centurion derived his from Caesar, 500 years later. Yes.
He was a great man in the sight of his master.
His master, okay. So, again, this emphasis that he has a master, so he's under the authority of the king of Syria.
And highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy.
Okay, so again, the Jews described the centurion in Luke chapter 7 in sort of glowing terms as worthy. So similar ideas to what Naaman is described here in Kings.
Now bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife.
Okay, so what does she do? Serve. So she's a servant of Naaman's wife. So we've got another mistress in this case, mistress servantess, maid, I've got in the King James. Female servant relationship here.
She said to her mistress.
Mistress, yep, good one. Carry on.
If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy. Naaman went to his master.
Yep, good, well done, good pausing.
Continue.
Yep.
And told him what the girl from Israel had said. By all means, go, the king of Aram.
Okay, so what does he say? Go. Okay, so the king says go. As in the words of the centurion in Luke 7, go, and he goeth.
The king of Aram replied, I'll send a letter to the king of Israel. So Naaman left.
Okay, so the king's told him go, and he goes, just like a servant should do.
Taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, with this letter, I'm sending my servant Naaman.
Servant, yep.
So that you may cure him of his leprosy.
Okay, so again, sort of lots of servant, master, maid, mistresses, lord, servant, king, and servant relationships in this section. Now, of course, the king of Syria, or what does your translation say?
King of Aram.
Aram, okay, says... he thinks that the king of Israel is going to be the master of this situation, doesn't he? He thinks he's going to have the authority to heal Naaman's leprosy. But, of course, he has no such authority. And the reason is, of course, because he has no faith. So here we're going to see one example of the faithless Jewish servant, just like in Jesus' day with the elders of the Jews. They're sort of, they appear to be in positions of authority, but because of their lack of faith, they're not. Yes, next reader. Thanks, Daisy. You can do verse, I don't know, 7 to 10.
And when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, am I God to kill and make alive? This man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy. Only consider and see how he's seeking a quarrel with me. But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king.
Sent, yep. So he sends, probably via a servant, didn't go himself. So he sends, yep.
Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come now to me, that you may know that there is a prophet in Israel. Now Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house.
So sort of, you know, presumptuously, I guess, Naaman sort of rolls up to Elisha's house, no doubt with sort of great pomp, surrounded by his... you know, retinue, entourage, his guards, servants, maybe a, you know, flourish from the trumpeter as he comes to a halt. And we can really sort of contrast this, I think, at this stage with the centurion who sort of refuses to presume on Christ. Remember in Luke chapter 7, when Jesus wasn't too far from his house, the centurion sent friends to him saying, trouble not thyself, for I am not worthy that you should enter unto my roof. Wherefore neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee, but saying a word, and thy servant shall be healed. So it's quite a contrast at this stage between the attitude of Naaman and the centurion in Luke chapter 7. Yes.
And Elisha sent a messenger to him.
Sent, messenger, yep, go on. Saying,
go.
Go, yes, excellent. Yep.
In the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean.
Okay, so yes, go and wash in Jordan, and thy flesh shall come again unto thee. So again, he's sending messengers saying, go, exactly the same sort of terms as we've seen in Luke 7. So it's sort of a real prologue, I guess, to the centurion's word. I say, go, and he goeth. And now, of course, the instruction is issued from Elisha to Naaman, like a master to a servant, isn't it? And Elisha says to Naaman, go and wash. Now, the question is now, would Naaman be a faithful servant? Would he go when his master, would he acknowledge that Elisha is his master effectively in this situation? Would he go when his master said go? Now, you'll note that in verse 10 that Elisha sent a messenger here, and it seems that he only had one servant, as far as we know, Gehazi, who proved to be a faithless Jew, and we're going to learn more about him a little bit later. So in a similar way to the centurion sending the sort of faithless Jewish elders to Jesus to ask for a miracle that they refused to believe in, Elisha sends his faithless Jewish messenger, and we'll see how faithless he is later, to instruct Naaman in a miracle that this servant refuses to believe in. Now, in the King James, it says that Naaman's flesh will come again. So the idea of him saying, go and he goeth, and come and he cometh, is here. So Naaman's flesh really is Elisha's servant as well. In the same way that Jesus had command over death and disease, so Elisha sort of has that same master-servant relationship here. So Elisha will say, come, and Naaman's flesh will come, sort of like an obedient servant. But, verse 11. 14, thanks, Soph.
But Naaman was wroth and went away and said, behold, I thought he would surely come out to me.
Okay, so he's saying, surely Elisha should be coming out to me. He'd be my servant. I should be able to tell him to come out, and he comes out to me. So he thought at this stage that he's the master here. He thought he could say, come to Elisha, and Elisha would come. So Naaman's, the real lesson he has to learn is who is the master and who is the servant in truly in this sense.
And stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and strike his hand over the place and recover the leper.
Okay, so once again, sort of another contrast with the humility of the centurion, at least at this stage. So Naaman expects this dramatic expression, demonstration of God's power. Now, the centurion knows that Jesus just has to say the word and his servant will be healed. Jesus doesn't even need to be, you know, present for the miracle to occur. But Naaman's sort of hoping for something slightly more dramatic here.
But not a banner and of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel. May I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in rage. And His servants came near and spake unto him and said, my father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldest thou have done it? How much rather than when he said to me, wash and be clean?
Okay, so the question here is from Naaman's servants, is Naaman going to acknowledge who the true master is here? Will he acknowledge that Elisha, or you know, God, who he represents, is the master here? That he can make Naaman do his bidding and not the other way around? Will he hear the sayings of his master and do them? And we know that he does, because in verse 14...
Then went he down.
Okay, so hooray. Elisha says go, and Naaman went. He's gone. He's humbled himself to a servant level, hasn't he? He's taken sort of that first step towards salvation.
And dipped himself 7 times in Jordan, according to the saying.
According to the saying. So he's done it according to the words that he's, you know, followed exactly the words that Elisha says.
The saying of the man of God, and his flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean.
Excellent. Okay, so he's done, you know, the servant master thing here, hasn't he? He's become the servant in this instance. Josh, probably about end of verse 18, I think, for you.
And he returned to the man of God, he and all his aides, and came and stood before him.
Okay, so now he stands before Elisha himself, doesn't he? So, yeah, we'll notice back in verse 9, Naaman had stood at Elisha's door, but he got sort of no further. Elisha spoke to him through a messenger. He didn't speak to him face to face. But now he stands before Elisha, doesn't he? He's acknowledged the authority of Elisha, which of course was derived from God, and Elisha speaks with him directly now.
And he said, "Indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth, except in Israel."
Okay, so again, like the centurion, Naaman recognises that Elisha hasn't done this in his own power, doesn't he? There's no God in all the earth. It's not you, Elisha, who did this miracle, but it's a God. It's the God of Israel who's done it. And the centurion in Luke 7 says that Christ was under authority, under the authority of God. And Naaman here, I think, sees that Elisha is also under the authority of the God of Israel.
Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant.
Okay, servant. So Naaman has obeyed the sayings of Elisha. He's gone when Elisha told him to go. And now he recognises his true status in as many words. "I'm your servant," he says now to Elisha. Just as the centurion in Luke 7 calls Jesus Lord, so Naaman here acknowledges that same master relationship between himself and Elisha.
But he said, "As the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will receive nothing. And he urged him to take it, but he refused.
So Elisha's not Naaman's servant, isn't he? He can't be told what to do by Naaman. He can refuse him.
So Naaman said, "Then, if not, please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth. Your servant will no longer offer either burnt offering or sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord. Yet in this thing may the Lord pardon your servant."
Okay, so that's 3 times is called himself in his servant in those 2 verses, "thy servant, thy servant, thy servant." And then?
"When my master goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord please pardon your servant."
Okay, so he recognizes he's still under the authority of his king back in Syria, but he knows his true service is to Elisha and to Elisha's God. So this faithful Gentile army captain is granted his request for healing. So once he acknowledges that he is the servant of the God of Israel, so once he acknowledges that you know, the only one with authority over leprosy, over sin, over death, which all these things represent, is the God of Israel, and the one whom he has sent, in this case Elisha, and obviously in Luke 7 it's Jesus himself. So he shows this servant-master relationship by going when he's commanded to go. But what about our faithless Jewish servant? Tan, do you want to read a chunk? Okay, take it away. You've got up to verse 27.
"John, and he said unto him, Go in peace. So he departed from him a little way. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha..."
Well, good emphasis.
"The man of God said, Behold, my master..."
Yeah, nice.
"...bear name of the Syrian..."
So he calls him his master. He called him Lord, Lord, isn't he? But is he really doing what his master tells him to do? That's the question here for Gehazi or Gehazi. I don't know how you pronounce it, to be honest. So it says Elisha is his master, but is he really his master? That's the question here.
"In not perceiving in his hands that which he brought. But, as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him. So Gehazi followed after Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot to meet him and said, Is all well? And he said, All is well. My master hath sent me."
Okay, so had he sent him? No, he hadn't sent him, had he? He hadn't told his servant to go, and he goeth. This servant had nicked off on his own accord.
saying, "Behold, even now they have come to me from Mount Ephraim, two young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and two changes of garments." And Naaman said, "Be content, take two talents." And he urged him and bound two talents of silver and two bags and two changes of garments, and laid them upon two of his servants.
Okay, so you'll notice, just by way of comparison, the generosity of Naaman the Gentile here. He's giving, you know, silver and gold to the Jews, just as the centurion in Christ's day, you know, was to do through the giving of the alms, as the Jews ascribed it to Jesus, and building of a synagogue.
And they bare them before him. And when he came to the tower, he took them from their hand, bestowed them in the house, and he let the men go, and they departed. And he went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said unto him, "Whence comest thou,
Mahazai?" So Elisha's his master, as it says there in verse 25. But, you know, we know that Elisha hadn't told him to go, and yet Gehazi had gone. Where had he gone? Where was he coming from? That his master wants to know, where are you coming from that I hadn't sent you to?
And he said, "Thy servant went no whither." And he said unto him, "Went not my heart with thee?" And the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee. Is it a time to receive money and receive garments and oliveyards and vineyards and sheep and oxen, men servants and maid servants? Let us see therefore a name and shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever. And he went out from his presence and let not his white stone.
Okay. So Naaman, the Gentile army captain, and of course the Gentile centurion, had overcome sin by faith. In the authority of God and of God's servants, hadn't they? But the Jewish servants, on the other hand, Gehazi and the elders of the Jews, they'd lacked the faith to do this. They knew God, they'd heard his sayings, they'd all seen lots of miracles. Both the Jews in Jesus' day had seen heaps, obviously, but also, you know, Gehazi in Elisha's day had seen quite a number of miracles as well. But somehow they couldn't take the next step. The Jewish elders couldn't believe that they needed healing, not from leprosy, of course, but from sin and its consequence, death. They couldn't sort of apply those same principles that they saw in the miracles to their own life. And that's why Gehazi gets, you know, struck down as a leper, white as snow. He couldn't apply the same principles that he saw in Naaman to himself. Naaman saw God's power. He believed in God. He, you know, believed in the presence of God no matter where he was. He knew that God would see him even in the house of Rimmon, you know, this temple, you know, to a false god way over in Damascus. But Gehazi couldn't believe that God could see him when he trotted, you know, just a couple of hundred metres down the road. But in verse 26, Elisha asks, "Went not my heart with thee?" So the issue was not sort of faith per se. I don't think that, you know, no doubt Gehazi knew that God could perform miracles. He'd seen plenty, as we've already said. But the issue is in applying faith, isn't it? It's doing what is knows is right. There's that, again, that disconnect between the message and the messenger that carried it. And the disconnect wasn't revealed in what they said, because they said the right things mostly, but it was really revealed in what they did. They heard the words of their Lord, but they didn't do them. So we see, obviously, the miracles all around us, Israel. We've seen the miracle of the resurrection in Christ himself. And we've seen the miracle of our own sins being forgiven as well. And we say he is our master. We call him Lord, Lord. But are we his servants? Well, we are if we do what he commands. So final quote is 1 John chapter 2. Well, final couple of quotes, all from 1 John. 1 John chapter 2 to start with, and verse 4. So 1 John 2, and it's the same lesson, just different words. 1 John 2, verse 4, "He that saith," so this is what we say, "I know him, but keepeth not his commandments," doesn't do them, "is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoso keepeth his words, in him verily is the love of God perfected. Hereby know we that we are in him. He that saith he abideth in him ought himself also so to walk as he walked. So it's about behaviour, it's about actions, isn't it? It's not about what we say in verse 4. You can say, I know him, as much as you like, but if you don't keep his commandments, if we don't walk as he walked, if our knowledge of Jesus is not is reflected just in what we say but not in what we do, then it's all pointless. Over a couple of pages to 1 John 3, verse 18. Again, same ideas, just different words. My little children, 1 John 3, verse 18, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Not just words, but actions. So our fellowship with Christ and with each other must be seen in our actions. Otherwise, we're not going to receive the forgiveness of our sins. Is it enough to mouth the words, to sort of pray, Lord, Lord, forgive me, to acknowledge Jesus as our Lord and Master? Well, the truth is, of course, no, our actions have to match our words as well. It's not enough to call him Lord, he must be our Lord. So finally, back in 1 John chapter 1 and verse 6 and 7. If we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not the truth. But if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanseth us from all sin.